The House Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee shall come to order. A quorum is present. Vice Chair Coulter, have you had the opportunity to review the minutes from our March 13th, 2025 meeting? And if so, would you be willing to move their adoption?
Mr. Chair, as long as there are absolutely no follow-up questions, yes.
Representative Coulter moves the approval for the minutes of March 13th, 2025. Is there any member discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the minutes for March 13th, 2025 are approved. Members, the first item on our agenda for today is a presentation from the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership. And if the testifier would please make their way to the table, we will then be hearing Representative Frazier's bill, followed by Representative Clardy's bill, and finishing strong with Representative Perryman's bill. It is my great honor and privilege to welcome back a friend and mentor of mine, former Chair Carlos Mariani, with the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership. Representative Mariani, welcome to the Higher Education Committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Super. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What a pleasure to see you again. And where's Madam Chair? Oh, there you are. Yeah. It's good to see you both. And, of course, another chairperson I know is in the room as well. I was with you last week. My name is Carlos Mariani Rosa. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership. As you heard, members and chairs, as a former member of this body, I got to serve with a number of you, including these three chairs and a fourth chair as well. I keep looking around and oh my goodness, and another one, yeah. So lots of good people here. It was an incredible privilege for me to do what you do, lawmaking for the state of Minnesota, and helping to continually provide energy and hope and vision for our people, our great state. And it's in that spirit that I join you here today. I am joined by my two colleagues, Tambriana Williams, who's the director of our college race equity work at MNEP. Ms. Williams joined us about 5 or 6 months ago. And then also my good friend, Leah Tawa, Dr. John Peterson, who's our senior policy fellow at MNEP. You will hear from them later on the bill. You'll just be hearing from me at this point. And Mr. Chair, I have about 8 minutes, so hopefully that'll fit your timeline. I know all about trying to make these timelines work, man. It's tough work. MNEP came into, and MNEP is the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership. MNEP came into existence in the late 80s as a result of a group called by local philanthropists trying to figure out why their financial scholarship support for college students of color, while successful, was not producing the same rates of degree completions as their white peers. Understanding that an important part of our state's well-being depended on greater success rates among students of color, indigenous students, an impressive group of Minnesotans came together to explore this question and was led by the great American Indian educator and eventual MNEP founder and my dear friend, the great Ron McKinley. The group included University of Minnesota President Dr. Niels Hassemel, the Minnesota Higher Education Coordinating Board Director, Dr. David Longenegger. HECB, by the way, is now the Office of Higher Ed. President of Augsburg University, Dr. Paul Anderson, about as sweet a man as you'll ever meet in your life. Directors of the three state councils of color and the American Indian Council. Minneapolis City Council President Sharon Sales Belton, leader, became mayor of Minneapolis, her counterpart Bill Wilson on the St. Paul City Council, state trio directors, several large public K-12 school district superintendents, and the heads of several local foundations. It was quite an impressive group of good Minnesotans. The basic conclusion of the group was the need to create a way to sustain a focus on learning and sharing effective practices for supporting students, for developing new policies and directing resources to implement those practices and to do all that across systems. MNEP was born, we were actually first called MMEP to reflect the times, the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership. MNEP was born to be that coming together place. The HECB requested legislative funds to support that effort and at one point received $50,000 a year for MMEP. It's been stuck at $45,000 since the late 1990s, which of course with inflation has eroded the state's ongoing investment in the collaborative table. Much of our financial support, however, comes from private foundations here and nationally. Much has changed since those days, always influenced by the work of MNEP. Three higher ed systems came together to create what is now MnState. A common commitment to student finances has produced a tense but firm agreement for a student financial aid system accessible for private, public, and land-grant attending students. The HECB became a governor's commissioner-led state department and now, as I shared, is called the Office of Higher Education. Minnesota adopted a new K-12 school integration program. I actually authored that bill. Minnesota adopted a new K-12 English language learner framework, which I also authored. Minnesota adopted a new federal accountability system, ESSA, after the NCLB era, based on MNEP's work with parents of several language communities to identify high-quality academic English outcomes. Minnesota strengthened its work to diversify our K-12 teacher ranks and did so based on research and advocacy coalition that MNEP guided. MMEP changed its name. And challenges to Minnesota's education systems have also changed, sometimes for the better and sometimes becoming more acute. The percentage of the state's budget allocated for higher education has diminished since those days. Post-secondary affordability is challenging for many students, even with the new free college program and with important state aid adjustments. Minnesota education systems, SLEDs, Office of Higher Ed, MnState, et cetera, now regularly keep data disaggregated by race and culture as well as other demographic data so we can better plan and deliver effective education opportunities. Minnesota college campuses have grown more effective in supporting the diversity of student needs and by doing so are slowly moving better education attainment outcomes even as we need to pick up the pace. The numbers of students of color, Indian students, and post-secondary has grown, but huge percentages still do not move into higher education from our K-12 systems, and disparities in accreditation outcomes continue. Our K-12 schools continue to have some of the largest gaps in student outcomes across the nation. So, MNEP continues to be a common place for learning and sharing. We draw educators, administrators, nonprofit providers, students, and their families into ongoing engagements on how to make our schools and colleges better. Together, they conduct research, like the State of Students of Color American Indian Students report we issue every 4 years or so, that identifies promising pedagogies and reports out where we are at as a state with student success. We maintain a research collaborative table to guide that work that draws from both post-secondary and K-12 institutions as well as community groups. Together, they also develop policy briefs and recommendations for state action, such as the Minnesota Reducing Racial Disparities in College Completion Brief that Dr. John Peterson, I believe, is sharing with the committee today. Together, they also form a College Race Equity Advisory Committee that convenes community-based conversations to lift up the importance of education in Minnesota, such as the College Campus Race Equity Series, one which we held recently at Minneapolis College, and prior had held at Moorhead State, Concordia College in Moorhead, Bethel College, the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and the Minnesota System offices with broad statewide participation from campuses like yours, Mr. Chair, St. Cloud, Mankato, Duluth, and Rochester. Together, we advocate for laws that strengthen our state's mission in education. In 2015, MNEP took part in a bipartisan effort to establish Minnesota's college attainment goals, setting a target, as you know, of 70% of those ages 25 and 44 in Minnesota for obtaining a certificate or degree by this year, 2025. We're actually almost made it. That attainment correlates with increased earnings, lower unemployment, better health, and other social and economic benefits that can drive a strong state. Together, we also provide training for educators through the MNEP Race Equity Training Center for school districts like Hopkins and Duluth and for many charter schools. Through the years, MNEP has worked with both DFL and Republican state administrations, pursuing ways to make our education system effective for all students. MNEP believes a quality education system that can meet Minnesota's need for strong economic and social prosperity and for healthy and just communities is not a partisan issue. For that, our education systems need to keep changing. And we know they want to change and they want to evolve for the better. MNEP exists to help make that happen all across our K through 16, bless you, our K through 16 education systems. Mr. Chair, with that, that concludes my sharing for today. There's so much more to share for an organization that's over 30 years old and that I've been affiliated with for 20 years. So please know I'm available to each and every one of you in the committee for further questions or more information or advice. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you here today, even though I don't want to make it a habit to come to the Capitol very often, but it is really good to be here with you today.
Well, thank you for that thoughtful presentation, Representative Mariani. And do we have any member questions? Co-Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Chair. Good to have you back. I was going to call you Representative Mariani. You know, it just flows out after so many years. So one thing that we've been doing differently across several committees, actually not just this committee, but we've been looking at each of the nonprofits, 990s and audited financials and kind of the salaries of the top highest paid people. And I didn't have that in the packet, so I just looked at it really, really quickly. And the IRS has a 2022 990. So I just wanted to get that on the record because I'm actually impressed and pleased with what I see. So I wanted to point that out too. And in you had a gross revenue of $563,000 or so in 22. Your expenses exceeded that. So I'm not sure how you made up the loss, but you had $942,000 in expenses. So you did have a net loss. But we also looked at, so on the 990 talks about the highest paid people, and you're the executive director, so and your salary is completely reasonable. I think it's, we talk about, are you above or below the governor's salary? Because you know why, because as you were here as a member, we talked about that on the subcommittee on employee relations a lot, and you have to get, well, up until the last 2 years, you had to get special permission to pay anybody more than the governor. But your salary is well below that, so that's fantastic. You have five employees with the last 990, and maybe you have more. I don't know now, but it looks like five. And the total government grants that you've gotten is the 90,000, so it's a low percentage of your total. And so I wanted to get that on the record because here's an example of a nonprofit that's doing good work that is following sort of the parameters of what I would hope to see from a nonprofit. You know, you've got five people, no one's getting paid crazy amounts of money. You've got revenue mostly coming from, like you said, private donations, and it looks like you've got some fundraising, so you're working really hard to raise your money. And so I just wanted to get that on the record too, because we've had a complete variety of nonprofits come, and I wanted to give you that accolade and the gold star for this whole session, I think, of really good nonprofits that have come. Although Cook County Higher Ed, I mean, they might get my gold, like the platinum star, but they get a gold star.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Chair Rarick. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Rarick. Leading a nonprofit is not easy work, I can tell you, but it's incredibly rewarding work. One of the peculiarities of nonprofits is, or at least ours, is that there are cycles that we're constantly writing. You know, so we'll get a grant from a foundation that's a 2 or 3 year grant, for instance. And depending on how your accounting system is set up, that's either booked in that year or not booked in that year. So we've always balanced our books. But for any given year, you know, you're going to see a shortfall or you'll see a large gain. And then those are basically sequestered to be used for later years. I don't know what the governor makes nowadays. I can't imagine that we pay any governor enough to put up with the headache, but I'm glad to hear that I don't make as much as the governor.
Chair Eric.
Thank you. So currently he has been offered $149,000 and some change. He's rejected that, and he's maintained his salary of $127,000, okay. For the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, is there any further questions or discussion to this presentation? Seeing none, we will transition. The Manib team can stick around because we are going to transition to Representative Frazier's bill, House File 2090. And while Representative Frazier is making his way to the testifier table, I will move that House File 2090 be laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair.
Representative Frazier, welcome to the Higher Education Committee. We're grateful to have you here. Please present to us House File 2090.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, and members. Thank you for having me here today. always hate to follow up behind Chair Mariani, but since this is supportive of the great work that he's been doing with NEEP and the folks will be happy to testify, it is an honor to do so in this moment. House File 290 is a bill that would allow Minnesota to take bold steps to make higher education more affordable, accessible, and equitable for all students. With rising costs and persistent barriers to college completion, these initiatives aim to expand financial aid, increase student support, and secure the long-term stability of the state's higher education system. To ensure that financial aid keeps pace with the real cost of living, the state grant living allowance will increase from 115% to 121% of the federal poverty guideline, helping students cover essential expenses. Additionally, the state grant plus scholarship program will provide eligible students with an extra 25% of their state grant award, reducing financial strain and making college more attainable. Beyond tuition assistance, the bill also focuses on boosting college access and completion with FAFSA completion grants that will support nonprofits in increasing the number of high school seniors applying for financial aid, ensuring more students receive the assistance they qualify for. At the same time, competitive grants for Pell-eligible student retention and graduation will help institutions develop targeted strategies to support low-income students, keeping them on the path to earning a degree. Recognizing the diverse needs of Minnesota's student population, funding will be allocated for multilingual and culturally relevant educational materials, ensuring that non-English speakers and underrepresented communities have the tools they need to navigate college and financial aid systems. Additionally, continued support for the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership, MNEEP, will further advance policies that promote racial and educational equity across the state. To secure the long-term stability of higher education funding, the Minnesota Office of Higher Education will establish a working group on higher education financial stability, tasked with developing sustainable funding strategies. Another working group will review and update Minnesota's higher education attainment goals, ensuring that the state remains aligned with workforce demands and economic growth. Together, these initiatives remove financial barriers, support student success, and strengthen the future of higher education in Minnesota. By investing in students today, the state is laying the foundation for a stronger, more prosperous future for all Minnesotans. And with that, Mr. Chair and Madam Co-Chair, I will allow for my testifiers to testify.
Representative Frazier, thank you for that thoughtful presentation on House File 2090. If you would please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Tammy Williams, and I'm here on behalf of MNEEP. I work as the Director of College Race Equity, and I'm here to express our support for including the Higher Education Attainment Goal Working Group in this bill. So as you heard from Carlos Mariani, for over 20 years, MNEEP has been actively involved in higher education initiatives focusing on retention and financial aid reform. We have organized regional and state convenings, consistently hearing the need for increased funding. Our support for the North Star Act underscores our dedication to these efforts. Manip established CREAC, which is the College Race Equity Advocacy Advisory Council. This is a statewide multiracial advocacy group dedicated to advancing race equity within Minnesota's higher education systems. CREAC comprises of members from OHE, Office of Higher Education, Minn State, Minnesota Private Colleges, leaders from various colleges and universities, and several student voices. Notably, CREAC members contributed to developing some of the provisions in this bill. Minnesota's economic success hinges on a skilled and educated workforce. As our state experiences demographic shifts and growing workforce shortages, ensuring that more Minnesotans can access and complete post-secondary education becomes not just an educational priority, but an economic necessity. This working group has the potential to drive economic growth, reduce dependence on social services, and expand opportunities for all Minnesotans by strengthening our attainment goals and aligning them with the industry needs. By bringing together stakeholders from higher ed, the private sector, and community organizations, this working group aims to ensure that our education system prepares students for the jobs of tomorrow. When more students complete college and enter the workforce ready to succeed, Minnesota benefits from a stronger economy, higher earnings, and a greater, more competitive environment and sustainability. At Manif, we firmly believe that when students succeed, Minnesotans succeed. Supporting this provision is a wise investment in our state's future. Thank you for your time, and I welcome any questions that you all may have.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Williams. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Leotawa Dr. John Peterson, and I work with the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership, MNEEP, as a Senior Fellow and Director of Policy. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 2090. Investing in higher education in ways that better support students and systems is a moral and economic imperative for our state. Despite the current fiscal realities that we are facing, it is critically important that we continue to invest in higher ed if we are to achieve the academic and economic goals we have set for our students and for our communities. Over the past 6 years, I've had the privilege of being in relation and community with students, faculty, institutional partners, and staff working at the Minnesota Office of Higher Education and P20 Educational Partnership. And while we may not agree on everything, we do agree on one thing. Our students matter and higher education systems matter. Both matter. HF 2090 seeks to advance provisions in support of our collective agreement about what matters in higher education. Whether it be providing additional financial resources directly to students via the state grant, or offering competitive grants designed to help systems and institutions increase student retention and college completion, the purpose of this bill is singular: to uplift the importance of higher education in Minnesota and reduce disparities in college completion with a credential or degree based on race. Supporting this bill through public discourse about its provisions will serve to increase our consciousness, conviction, and commitment, what we at Manip call the three C's of change, to do better so that each of us may be better. The health of our state depends upon a higher education ecosystem that can adapt to ever-shifting political, economic, and social realities by tapping into the brilliance of our students. Representative Frazier's bill does that. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, and committee members for providing space to be heard and seen in support of our students, systems, and state. Faftai Manwilo Aso. And I'd be happy to address any questions you may have about the bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Frazier, I understand you have one further testifier today. If they please proceed to the table, and if you would please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jama Jigo. Thank you all for the opportunity to testify today. I am a student at Augsburg University, double majoring in international relations and communications. I am also a Capital Pathways intern who is working with NAMI Minnesota during this legislative session. However, I am here today as a student supporting House File 2090 and its provisions on increases to living and miscellaneous expenses, or LME, and the creation of the State Grant Plus Scholarship. Students like myself enjoy benefits of private higher education in Minnesota, including smaller class sizes, specialized undergraduate programs, and particularly at Augsburg, I receive a liberal arts education committed to intentional diversity. Being a student at a private college means that I am able to receive the state grant, which has filled in a large gap between my tuition, meal plans, books, and other costs associated with being a full-time college student. However, I am not a recipient of the North Star Promise Scholarship. And with the current state grant shortfall we all face, I have growing concerns about being able to afford school. When graduating from Anoka High School in 2021, attending school in an environment that promoted unique perspectives and allowed me to discover my vocation in an urban setting was necessary, as I am a commuter student who travels from the northwest suburbs of Ramsey to Minneapolis for my classes. Increasing living expenses that is taken into account in the state grant formula ultimately raises the amount of financial aid I receive that can be used for expenses outside of tuition, which includes cost of commuting. Not having a large financial aid balance has created time for extracurricular involvement and has alleviated my concerns about finances, allowing academics to be a priority in my life. Attending a nonprofit private university has also opened doors for my involvement in the Minnesota Association of Private College Students, or MAPSIS, and my current testimony today, along with advocating for other issues affecting students attending private colleges. Education is a paramount belief for all members of this committee, but for me personally, it has written my story. As a first-generation student, my parents immigrated to Minnesota from South Sudan in 1998 in hopes of a better life. And the chance of receiving a quality education is one of the many reasons why they left the war-torn country as refugees. Once my parents both became U.S. citizens, my father then enlisted in the U.S. Army in 2008, partly to afford my siblings and I the opportunity to attend higher education with lowered costs due to the GI Bill and other financial assistance that is offered to active duty service members and their dependent family members. Additionally, I have applied to and received an array of scholarships and grants before and during my studies at Augsburg to compensate for not receiving aid from programs similar to the North Star Promise. As much gratitude as I have for all these opportunities, I wish for these funds to be shared amongst my classmates, not only at Augsburg, but across this whole state. This is where the Minnesota State Grant and now the State Grant Plus Scholarship will afford and empower students like myself, who historically are not seen in certain institutions and systems, the chance to attend college and fulfill their destiny to be part of the future generation who could be responsible for advocating and making decisions for Minnesotans. Because I am set to graduate this upcoming fall, I worry that I might not have enough financial assistance to finish my undergraduate degree. Between finishing my credits, working as a direct support professional full-time, interning with NAMI Minnesota, and having responsibilities within my family, the creation of the State Grant Plus Scholarship, along with the other proposals brought to this committee by the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership and Representative Frazier, will bring financial fairness and uphold the priority of higher education that this legislature has made. And for that, please support House File 2090, and I thank you all for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We will now move on to member discussion of House File 2090. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Frazier, thank you for bringing the bill. I have a question, though, about the appropriations are left blank. Do you have some estimate, guess, some target that you're looking at?
Representative Frazier.
I'm gonna defer. We left it blank, obviously understanding the budget situation that we have now, and we're continuing to have conversations around this. I'm gonna let Mr. Peterson comment if you'd like.
Dr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the one-time appropriations, I think any amount would be helpful. Honestly, the ongoing, we recognize, is going to be incredibly challenging during the current fiscal situation that the state is facing. We were hoping that we could get these ideas out on the table so that perhaps this body could have some conversation about the concept, the idea, with the knowledge that it is going to be tough to invest any more dollars than would have already been committed, or when you get to target, you know, you'll have a better idea of what's going on with the fiscal side of things. But the one-time appropriations would be helpful, whether it's the support to the nonprofits to help out with the FAFSA grant completion, whether it's providing some competitive grants to the Office of Higher Education for institutions to help with college completion or retention. Those would be one-time appropriations. So, thank you.
Anything further, Representative Novotny?
More follow-up.
Representative Navani.
Thank you, Chair Wilgamont. Representative Frazier, Dr. Peterson, do you have a per pupil that a target number that you're looking for, or a number of students that you want to help? Any? I mean, you had to have some. There's right. some dream number. If you had a in a perfect world, what would it be?
Dr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, which specific provision are you referencing?
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Wilgamont. You've got two lines, Section 10, the appropriation for the state grant scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
And that continues on to page 8-1. Those are blank appropriations. So in a perfect world, what would that number be?
Dr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, in a perfect world, I would say $50,000 for the one-time appropriations would help. I don't want to say it's a small amount, but when we look at the state of English learners in K-12, for example, they are the lowest performing students in the state. They fall 59 complete points on the MCAs behind their white counterparts. What we've heard feedback on is that some families struggle to find the way to understand some of the information that's on the Office of Higher Ed's website. So even $50,000 would be supportive of supporting the office to create more multilingual, culturally responsive resources on the website for families to access, especially in the case of multilingual learners and English learners. When it comes down to the state grant appropriation, I just want to find my notes here. This is what we'd be looking at. How much would the state grants plus scholarship be? The following is based on average state grants for the fiscal year 2024. And we could extrapolate off this information, I think, pretty easily based on the number of students that receive Pell Grants. At the University of Minnesota, the average state grant is about $6,100. A student with an average state grant would get a state grant plus scholarship of roughly $1,500. At nonprofit institutions, the average state grant is about $5,800. A student with an average state grant would get a state grant plus scholarship of $1,450. At Minnesota State Universities, the average state grant is about $3,200. A student with an average state grant would get a state grant plus scholarship of about $800. And then finally, at Minnesota State Colleges, the average state grant is about $1,400. A student with an average state grant would get a state grant plus scholarship of about $350. You'll also notice in the bill that the commissioner can raise or lower the 25% match level if there is a surplus or shortfall in the appropriation. And there's also a requirement to report back the progress of the program recipients. The idea is that it creates a little more parity for students who do not qualify for the North Star Scholarship Program. I know that there was a lot of discussion about the $80,000 threshold. And so it proportionally is a much smaller amount of investment, but serves students that currently lie outside of that eligibility for North Star.
Thank you, Chair.
We are going back to member discussion for House File 2090. Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Frazier, you've increased the LME, and do you happen to know, we don't have a fiscal note, so that's a significant change. Do you happen to know about what that would cost?
Representative Frazier.
We do not have the numbers yet, Chair Rarick. But I, you know, again, one of the main reasons that I wanted to carry this bill, and I'm usually not okay with not putting numbers in, but I understand we're in a unique situation this session, looking at what we're facing in the outlying years around budget difficulties. But I do think this is one of, after having conversations with constituents, students in my district that are impacted by this, it was very critical, important for me to be able to bring this conversation to the legislators so that we're thinking about it to make sure we can provide resources for those students in the future.
Anything further, Representative Rarick?
Thank you, yes.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the governor's proposal, he actually proposed to decrease the LME to 110%. You're proposing to increase it to 121%. So in my calculations, it's about $36 million more cost from the state grant program. And the state grant program already is $232 million short. If you kind of hold people harmless all the way through this whole process, we've had a massive hit. So just because you're not a part of this committee, that is basically the equivalent of one entire year's worth of state grant funding. So that's how much the hole is. So this would be creating a bigger hole of $36 million, not to even mention that's just the LME. So then all of the other things would be creating an even bigger hole. And since we don't have a fiscal note, I was just hoping that maybe you would know some of that, or, you know, be sensitive to some of that, because we're in a tough place. Even though we have about a $4 billion biannual budget, $232 million is a big hole in the state grant program. So this is making that hole much, much bigger. So I just thought I'd get that out there and see if he understood some of that. And we don't have a fiscal note, so we can't, you know. My numbers are pretty good, but you never know. Maybe it's more, maybe it's less. It's hard to know. I'm usually pretty accurate, but we'll see. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Frazier, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Co-Chair, no, thank you for bringing it up. I am very sensitive to the situation and the particulars that we're in now with the budget. I'm very aware of the deficit that the state grant program is facing now. But again, my main purpose for this is that it is something that needs to be discussed. When I've had conversations with the students that are being impacted that are concerned that they may not have that they may not be held harmless going into their next semesters for next year. Those are tough conversations to have, and I did promise them that I would make sure that I did my part in having a conversation to see what we could do as best we can to try to ease some of the anxiety that they're facing right now.
Further member discussion on House File 2090, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm actually asking this question for Representative Robbins, who had to go see a constituent. But she was asking, would the practicality of the situation be better off to expand the North Star Promise Program rather than maybe this approach?
Representative Frazier.
I don't have an answer for that. We haven't looked at that as a possibility, but I will say, I got to start texting members during committee meetings if we can get questions asked in real time like that. I like that.
Anything further, Representative Scott? Further discussion, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to Representative Frazier and to all of the testifiers. I don't really have a particular question. You know, knowing the financial situation that we have, I'm really glad that you brought this bill forward, because, you know, I'm just sitting here thinking about, and I'm thank you especially to the student who came and testified and told her story about how important this is, because it isn't just a private good, obviously. You know, it's great for a person who can go and get an education and move up the economic ladder and all that, but it's also a public good.
Yeah.
And when we think about the disparities that we have, that's just wasted talent that we all really need in the state. And we need to develop, we need everybody's talent to be developed as absolutely as far as they can go. In a lot of countries, higher education's free. Mm. Obviously, we're not there, but it's just, it's kind of a little bit heartbreaking to even really think about it, because, you know, people want to say, well, we're spending so much money in Minnesota, so much. But we have so much unmet need and things that are not handouts to anybody, but are really investments in public good. And I know, Representative Frazier, I know you are totally right there. But I just wanted to say that, because in this committee, obviously, we all care a lot about this. And we know we're not going to be able to meet the need. And this just really is making me sit here and think about how we're not going to really meet the need. And honestly, this kind of issue is one of the reasons I even ran for office in the first place a long time ago. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Further discussion to House File 2090. Recognize Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. And Chair Liebling said a lot of what I wanted to say, Representative Frazier. So Corona class always out here doing the right thing, and I appreciate that a lot. You know, we know that not being able to attain higher education holds so many people back from things that they do not need to be held back from. I am living proof of that, and I can't wait to see more people come and sit in seats like ours when they get opportunities like this. And so being able to stand in the light and do the right thing when we know better and have a chance to do better is exactly why I ran for office. So thank you for bringing this forward, and thank you for always doing the hard work. I appreciate you.
Is there any further member discussion? Seeing none, Representative Frazier, closing remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for a lively discussion and for good questions. I appreciate those. Again, acknowledging the budget situation we're in, the uniqueness of this session, I'll just say, I'll go back to an investment in our educational system so that all Minnesotans can have access to it is an investment in our state as a whole. I attended the entirety of my higher educational attainment here in the state of Minnesota, public and private. So I absolutely personally understand the financial burden of being able to complete those degrees. And I want to, and I believe we all do, as elected officials, as arbiters of our finances, we want to make sure that all of Minnesotans have access to our higher education system because it makes the state better for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. I renew my motion that House File 2090 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Finance Omnibus Bill. The bill is laid over.
You too.
Next up on the agenda is House File 982, a bill authored by Representative Clardy. All right, we are going to try to find Representative Clardy. And if she is not available, Representative Perryman, if you would be on standby. Thank you. All right, in the interest of the committee's time, Representative Perryman, if you would please come to the testifier table and present a bill that I'm proud to be a co-author with you on, as it is very important for the community that we represent together, and present House File 2229. Representative Perryman, welcome to the Higher Education Committee. I will move on your behalf that House File 2229 be laid over for consideration the Higher Education Finance Omnibus Bill. That is my motion. Representative Perryman, again, welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. My bill is pretty simple. It's very succinct. The bill will appropriate $3 million over fiscal year 26 to 27 in a legislative named grant for Center Care Residency Program. Pretty simple bill, but what about the what of House File 2229? It's not complicated either. The why of this request is very important. We need to address a crisis facing rural health care in greater Minnesota, where residents face a growing shortage of physicians at a time when the population is aging and requiring more health care. Today, 20% of U.S. residents live in rural areas. Yet, only 11% of physicians practice in these areas, and only 4% of incoming medical students come from rural areas. Furthermore, the median age of a rural Minnesota physician is 59 years old, and 33% plan to leave the profession within 5 years. Therefore, CentraCare has partnered with sponsoring organization, the University of Minnesota Medical School, to create several rural residency programs and tracks that directly combat this emergency. By training future physicians to serve rural Minnesota, they can help address the physician shortage crisis facing these communities. Investing in rural training is key to rural healthcare. Simply put, physicians tend to stay where they do train. This August, I am proud to say the new regional medical school in St. Cloud will welcome their first 24 students. We are very excited in St. Cloud about that. To ensure these students fulfill their mission to make rural life healthier, a robust residency program is necessary to train future physicians who will want to practice throughout rural Minnesota. Expanding residency offerings is essential. As the location of physicians' residency training is predictive of where they will ultimately want to put roots down and practice where they have been trained. Developing a physician workforce is a public benefit. While central care and community philanthropic, easy for me to say, partners are poised to support, poised to support funding gaps created by innovation and future funding gaps to create growth, the inception of rural-focused teaching hospitals supporting Greater Minnesota needs legislative action to bring this transformational opportunity to fruition. The average annual cost to train a resident is $184,000. The public benefit of this impact on the future of the rural workforce and rural health warrants support from the Minnesota legislature. CentraCare and the University of Minnesota have pursued, and they will continue to pursue all available funding streams via sustained federal funding, Medicaid support, and state and federal grants. Despite all these efforts and getting the grants that we might need, each program will operate at an annual budget deficit. I told you the what and the why, and I would like to ask and invite my testifiers to tell you the need and the impacts this appropriation will have.
Representative Perryman, thank you for that thoughtful presentation of your bill. If you would please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is Shali Prasad. I'm a professor of family medicine and community health at the University of Minnesota. I'm also the associate vice president for rural health. If you notice in the agenda, it says Jill Amsbury. I am not Jill Amsbury. Dr. Amsbury is a wonderful pediatrician from St. Cloud who's the assistant dean at our new medical school campus. And I'm going to channel her firstly because in the last few weeks, she's been making calls to candidates who've been accepted into the first batch at the CentraCare campus. 24 candidates from Central, West Central, and Southwestern Minnesota, all rural candidates. Brilliant candidates who some of them wouldn't have gone to medical school just from a proximity to take care of their family and other things. So this is an important determinant. We know that there are two main determinants to make sure that people go to rural practices. One of the best determinants we have across the U.S. is people coming from rural areas, students coming from rural areas. And I think the focus at the CentraCare campus has been very strongly towards that. We have satisfied that. And I'm excited because we do have some residency training opportunities at St. Cloud Hospital and a new one in Willmar, which just matched its first batch of residents yesterday. So we're all excited about it, but there's still a huge gap. And that gap is something very important to keep in mind because if we graduate 24 students per year from our brilliant, new, wonderful campus, and they leave to go to an urban area, which is likely going to happen. That's how majority of residency training in the U.S. is. They tend to stay in urban areas. That's the second predictor of when a doctor would go to a rural area. The first one is coming from a rural area. Second is how close is it to their residency training. So creating the space within the CentraCare institutions for residency training is a huge, huge need. And that's one of the reasons I feel this is a very important bill. I was a rural doc for many years, And I'll tell you, the energy that rural Minnesota has is a very important part of this, too. There are various economic modeling that has looked at what does the investment mean. I'm not talking about the healthcare part. The healthcare, obviously, you know, proximity to see a trusted provider is a huge part of, you know, healthcare delivery. But the economic modeling is something to keep in mind. Some of the modeling suggests that for every family medicine physician in rural area, the added economic benefit is about $1 million. If you have a family medicine doc who practices obstetrics, it's about $1.5 million. And that is beyond the benefit you see from just the healthcare delivery part. So I do feel that what we're talking about here is investment in the fantastic, it's not often that we see new medical school campus, so please forgive me, I'm really excited. This new medical campus is already creating that buzz about rural healthcare in Minnesota, which I think is a very critical point for us for the future. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. If you'd please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am Mike Blair. I am the Chief Financial Officer and the Senior Vice President of Academic Affairs for CentraCare. And I'd like to give a special thanks to Representative Perryman and to Chair Wolgamott for their support on this bill. Also, I'd like to thank Dr. Shali Prasad for his words. If we go back in time, it was about 3 years ago when Dr. Holman, who is the CEO of CentraCare, and Dr. Toller, who is the Dean of the Medical School, had a dream that we could collectively come together to better the health of rural Minnesotans. And it's, I'll tell you, it's just been a wonderful relationship working with Shiley. Shiley and myself co-chair the governance committee over this academic affiliation. Dr. Crawford has been involved, been driving the research side of it. Assistant Dean Emily Lawrence, Chief of Staff, has been deeply involved in that work. CFO Bill Seibert as well. So it's been a really fruitful relationship for us. But many of the things that Dr. Prasad talked about, you know, if we open the medical school, which we will, that medical school will open this fall, and as he talked about with Dr. Amsbury, and the emotion that comes from those students when they get accepted into medical school and they have the dream of practicing in a rural area, practicing in outstate Minnesota, the challenge that we all have is we can graduate them from medical school, and as most of you all know, they have to go on and train. And those training programs will last anywhere from 3 years to 7 years. So most of the training that we will do will be 3 years of residency program. So if you can imagine, we have 24 students who are graduating every year. And if it's a three, you know, on average, if it's a three-year residency program, that's 72 slots. So if we don't create those 72 slots, what's going to happen is exactly what Dr. Prasad said, is they're going to have to go elsewhere. And our chance of getting them to come back and practice in rural Minnesota goes down significantly. And I want to add just one other thing there. We want them to practice in rural Minnesota. If they practice at CentraCare, that's wonderful. They don't have to. If they want to go practice at Ellmere and Alexandria, if they want to practice in Brainerd, they want to practice in any rural area in Minnesota, we're happy to have them go there as well. But the reality of it is, as Representative Perryman said, is it's very costly to expand those residency programs. And we're estimating by the time we get to 72 residents, that will be an annual structural deficit of $10 million. And the challenge that we have at CentraCare is then we're going to have to divert the funding that would go into our clinical mission into the teaching mission. So we are working very, very hard. Dr. Jesse Roski, who is here with us today, is looking for any opportunities that we have at the federal level to get funding, any grants that we can. We have a $50 million philanthropic initiative out there as well. And we will also, at CentraCare, we will continue to fund this as well. And put that in perspective for you, we will fund over $40 million for the facilities, for the medical school, for the learner housing. In over 10 years, if we don't find additional funding, we're going to put in another $80 million. So over 10 years, CentraCare will be in for over $120 million. So we certainly are driven by this. We have a saying at CentraCare, and that is, if not us, then who's going to do this? And if we don't start it now, when are we going to start it? So with that, I will close my testimony, and Mr. Chair, I will turn it back over to you for questions that you may have with the group.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on House File 2229? Seeing none, we will open it up to member discussion. First on my list is Co-Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the previous biennium, there was a $10 million appropriation to stand this up. And I was hoping that you were going to kind of give us an update as to what you use the money for, and maybe even have a little slide presentation or something like we've had from other groups that have come when we've given them considerably less. So I'm wondering, since you don't have that presentation today, can you come back and do a presentation? And you can do it when I have the gavel if you want, and come back and do a presentation as to the $10 million and what it was used for exactly. And then the second part of my question is, you had, I believe Representative Perryman had said it's $184,000 per resident. I'm assuming that's per year, so because it's a three-year program. Okay. And so when I did the math really quick, so if we allocated the $1.5 million, that would be about eight residents. Am I doing the math correctly? So this would support eight residents of the 24 per year with the $1.5
million. Mr. Blair.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. Thank you, Chair Rarick. So we'll send you some information on the details of where the original $10 million is being spent. But just off the top of my head, these numbers will be pretty close. About $4 million of it goes to the startup of the medical school. And part of that is driven by the fact the medical school has been, we've been starting it up for the last 2 years, but we won't start getting tuition until next year. So $4 million is going to the medical school startup. $2 million is going to the residency program. Another $2 million is going through to the creation of a rural-focused research institute. And then the last will be for scholarships that we'll see out here in the next couple of years.
Anything further, Representative Rarick?
Let me look at my notes, Chair. Let's see. Yeah, so last question, and then I'll let lots of others ask questions. So you had mentioned a $50 million philanthropic push that you're trying to do and $120 million from CenterCare. So what is the all-in? So we gave the legislature appropriated $10 million in the last biennium. So what is the all-in that you're looking at to get this stood up and then go for the next 3 years, which would be the first program graduating?
Yeah, great.
Mr. Blair.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Thank you, Chair Rarick. So a couple things with that. Back to your earlier question. So for this biennium, we're looking at the total of $3 million or $1.5 million. That's really reflective of us having to get these residency programs up and started. And they do take a long time to get them going. So we'll see over the next couple of years, we will see roughly about an 8 increase in the residency programs, with the idea by the time we get to out to year 10, we should be at 72 total residents. When we calculate what the all-in cost for that will be over that 10-year period, there's going to be roughly about $50 million in structural deficit related to the residency program. But it's going to be much higher out in year 10, because that's when we're up to the full 72 versus the smaller number we have in the front two here. We also have committed to providing academic mission support into the regional campus, and that will also be over that 10-year period, roughly about $20 million. And then the remaining of that is both for the research institute. We're estimating over that time is going to be between $5 and $10 million. And then the last piece of that is the roughly $40 million that we're putting into the facilities.
Okay, thank you. Next up on our list of member questions, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Representative Perryman, for bringing the bill. And so I remember that Chair Wolgamott has been a big supporter of this, and he's gotten me to be a big supporter of it too, frankly. And I really appreciate the testimony. I really think this is important. It's a pretty exciting thing to get a new medical school branch and a new residency program. We desperately need this. But I also appreciated the questions, because I kind of had some similar questions. Being new to this committee, I had some similar questions to what Chair Rarick was asking, and I'm just still not exactly clear, you know, because unfortunately we're going to have to prioritize our whatever, if we even have any extra money to spend. It's going to be really a tough thing to do. And so does this program have a base right now? I mean, Chair Rarick, you said no. It was just the $10 million that you all got to for the startup and all that, so there's no base for this in the state budget? That's my first question, I guess.
Thank you for that commentary and question, Representative Liebling. I will give the floor to Mr. Savory from our fiscal research to answer your question.
Chair and members, the appropriation in FY24 was $10 million out of the higher education bill. It's a one-time appropriation, so there is no base moving forward for that particular line item.
Yeah.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that is kind of concerning. I mean, I guess that kind of shows the situation we were in 2 years ago. We had a lot of one-time funding and not ongoing funding, so you got some of the one-time funding, which is great, and now we're, you know, how do we keep this thing going? The other thing is I was listening carefully to some of the answers about the specificity about what the money was going to do, because the bill is very not specific. Their language is very not specific. So I don't know that I have an additional question to what Chair Rarick was asking, but I was kind of looking for the same sort of idea of what exactly is this going to do. And I guess I'll look forward to seeing a little bit more something that kind of brings together on paper to just show us kind of how, because again, you know, as much as I, you know, if in my world, where I usually work, which is health, $3 million isn't a huge amount of money, but I just know that we're going to be very tight, and I would like to be able to help make the case for this, but I think we need more specifics to help us make the case for it. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Mr. Blair, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Wolgamott. Yeah, I appreciate the comments there. We're certainly happy to provide more details in all the pieces to both that residency program and, as Chair Rarick offered earlier. And we have provided that detail to the university, of which they did present at higher ed what that was used for in aggregate, but we'll provide more details to what spending goes there. But I also appreciate your commentary as well that the first $10 million, which we are greatly appreciative to get that $10 million, that was very helpful in getting the med school going, getting the research institute underway, in getting this residency program going. So very grateful for that as well. But I think you did call something out there that we're going to commit to the growth up to 72. And it's going to generate a pretty significant deficit for us as well. And if it's possible to get that funding, you know, ongoing into the bill, which I believe has happened in the past, that necessary for center care, that's going to be helpful, right? Because as we all know, especially as a CFO at center care, we're always looking to, you know, see the challenges in healthcare. We're all well aware of the headwinds, financial headwinds that we're seeing in healthcare. We don't ever want it to get to a point where we have to choose between the clinical and the teaching mission. And that's why, you know, we've come here in part looking for support for this year as we're growing. The reason we haven't come for a much larger ask is we're still in that early phase of growing from the current 18 residents that we have over the next 2 years. But it's really after that where that structural deficit grows year after year as we get more of these residency programs up and open.
Thank you. Further member discussion to House File 2229. I recognize Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm strong support of that integrated model where there's teaching and learning at the same time the care is taking place. And quick question about the funding sources. Do you get federal funds through the Medicaid system for the residency program that is being established right now?
Mr. Blair.
Yep. Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. Members, yeah, thank you. Our current residency program of as mentioned, we have a total of 18 residents. We do get direct medical education for that. We also get IME, which is indirect medical education. You know, indirect medical education really even though it's called indirect medical in education, it's really intended to cover the clinical costs of treating more complex patients. But the other side of that is if you didn't have the residency program, you know, you wouldn't get that funding. So we do currently get Merck funding through the state. We do get IME funding through the feds. We do get direct medical education as well. It does not cover the cost of the 18 residents that we have today. We are running a structural deficit on the current 18. And as we talked about earlier, as we look to the future, we start with that current deficit on the 18, and we look at adding another 54, that's where we see over the long term it's going to create an increasing structural deficit each year.
Anything further, Representative Knorr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to ask the proposed cuts to some of the programs. That includes the residency program at the federal level. Have you guys considered the impact of the cuts from the federal government to your program?
We'll call up our expert here, which is Dr. Jesse Roski.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your response.
Thank you, Chair Wilgoma. My name is Dr. Jesse Roski. I'm an internal medicine physician with CentraCare, and my role is to be the GME medical director, so to develop these new residency program opportunities. So we're very concerned about the cuts we might see at the federal level. The other challenge is some of the programs we propose to make wouldn't be eligible for federal funding even with existing structure of how the funding is allowed. So the hospitals get a certain stipend that they're allowed per resident, and they are capped at a level set in 1997. There are very subtle ways that you can increase that cap through a couple of sections in the Consolidated Appropriations Act that allow us to grow our cap and get stipend for additional slots. But we will not be able to get federal stipend even for all the slots we have. So all along, we've been planning for how we're going to make up that structural deficit. Some of it will come from Merck. Some of it will come from our philanthropic opportunities. Some of it we're willing to support with our own operational funds because we believe in this mission. And we believe it's also to the public benefit, and which is why we're here today, hoping to seek all possible funding sources, including from the base.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No further questions.
Further member discussion, House File 2229. I recognize Representative Cleburne.
Thank you very much. And Representative Knorr asked one of the major questions. I was concerned about what we do if we lose that federal funding at the top. But then I just wanted to make this statement. The last 2 years, I've had the privilege of leading a task force on aging. And the work that you're doing with this residency program to grow more rural doctors is so important. Next to transportation, it was one of the largest things that we heard, transportation, housing, and getting medical care that they need all across our state. So as we look at this legislation, this focus on care and attention to our patients who are having greater distances to travel to seek medical care and fewer opportunities to have transit to get them there. It's really key, and I'm very excited and proud to support this legislation because this is a desperate need. And the money that you're asking for in the big picture is not great. However, in this budget year, it seems very difficult. So I don't know if we'll be able to help you this year or not until we have budget targets. But the work that you're doing is vital to our state and to the health of our to all Minnesotans. So just thank you very much. I'm very supportive of the work you're doing.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. Any further member discussion to House File 2229? I recognize Co-Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In listening to this conversation, I just wanted to add a little bit more context. And because we've walked through Chapter 41 spreadsheets pretty much every committee hearing that we've had, I just wanted to refresh everyone's memory of where we are already doing residency programs. And we actually had a spreadsheet that kind of put them together. But we have United Family Medicine, which is $1 million per biennium. We have the Hennepin County Medical Center, which is $1.29 million in the biennium, and the Addiction Medicine Fellowship at Hennepin County Medical Center, which is $540,000 for the biennium. So just to put that in context of the three programs that we currently support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Rarick. If you wanted to respond to that, please state your name for the record and proceed with your response.
Thank you, co-chairs. My name is Santo Cruz, Chief Legal Officer for Centricare Health. And I just wanted to comment on this last point that Chair Rarick pointed out. I was born in one of Centricare's critical access hospitals. My fifth daughter was born in one of our critical access hospitals. And one thing that we are really bad about, having grown up on a gravel road, I'll just indict myself, we're really bad about asking for help. We are very used to having to do things on our own in rural Minnesota. We do not have, I did not have, growing up, a next door neighbor. We had a neighboring farm. And it was a very difficult thing to feel like you needed help. This is an area where Centricare has come to the legislature saying, we're doing a lot on our own. We are leaning in heavily. We're putting in way more than any other party. But it is a public policy problem. It is a public sector problem that we're confronting. Yes, it's a problem that we hope to address with our business model, with our geography. But as Dr. Roski will tell you, many of these residencies will rotate through non-Centricare hospitals. And those non-Centricare hospitals are so excited to see those new residents because they want to recruit them to their practice as well because they need the help. And so I just want to make sure that Chair Rarick's point is really brought out. There is precedent for this committee to run residency programs in the base for other institutions. Centricare has had a residency program for many, many years and never asked for the help to do it. We've cobbled together through federal and state and other things. And it is never the right time to come and ask for money. I will agree, it is easier when there is a large surplus, and we're very, very grateful for getting part of that money. But as you heard from the beginning of the testimony from Representative Perryman, those statistics aren't going to change in terms of that 33% who's planning to retire in the next 5 years. And so we do have the size of our problem is significant, and the size of our request is relatively small. So we're very, very grateful, but we are here to ask for help, which is something that we don't do comfortably in greater Minnesota. So thank you.
Thank you. Is there any further member discussion to House File 2229? I recognize Representative Cleavorne.
Thank you. I just want to make sure there is a geriatric component to this. Is that right?
Absolutely. Okay. So Representative Cleavorne, your point about how our aging population desperately needs these physicians is absolutely right. So we looked at the needs assessment, everything that we really think is critical to accessing care in rural greater Minnesota, and family medicine is the backbone of that. So the greatest area where we're planning to grow is in family medicine, where they specialize in cradle to the grave. But I think we also need to acknowledge that when we manage to train a full-spectrum family medicine physician, they deliver babies. And so I live in a rural area too, right? I am privileged, I'm educated, I have professional connections, and I was a high-risk pregnancy and I had to drive 45 minutes in active labor to deliver my son. And that is a uniquely terrifying thing, even as a physician where you know what's going on. That is the reality for moms and babies in greater Minnesota as we lose access to obstetric care. And training full-spectrum family medicine is key to that. We also don't have pediatricians in 40% of the counties in Minnesota. That means 190,000 kids in Minnesota don't have access to a pediatrician if they have complex care needs that need to be met locally. For adults, we know that we're seeing spikes in suicide rates in Minnesota, and access to psychiatric care is critical. Right now, in adult behavioral health in St. Cloud, we cannot accept new patients because we do not have enough access to care. There's a critical need for our aging population where among it's our aging residents where we see the spike in suicide rates. We want to address the needs of access to primary care for our rural residents across the entirety of their spectrum. We want to keep young families healthy in their communities, and we want to keep elderly people aging well in their communities. Thank you.
Representative Cleavorne. Is there any further member discussion to House File 2229? Representative Perryman, I want to thank you for bringing this bill before our committee today and express how proud I am to partner with you on the establishment of the St. Cloud Medical School. I would like to bring it back to what you said in your presenting remarks, the statistic that 20% of Americans live in a rural area, but only 11% of physicians practice in rural areas. That is a jarring discrepancy, and by bringing this bill forward and by continuing our state's investment in the St. Cloud Medical School, we can help close that gap and make sure that all of our constituents from all across the corners of the state have the access to the care that they need. when they need it. So again, Representative Perryman, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I'm so proud to partner with you on this legislation, and I would like to give you the opportunity to bring it home with some closing remarks.
Well, thank you, Representative Welgemont, and thank you for being co-sponsor with me, along with Representative Backer and Baker are on the bill. I think a lot of the good things were already said by my testifiers and my own reps here in this room. So I am not going to get technical as much as speak to local care. In 2018, I was diagnosed with a very aggressive cancer, and I live in St. Cloud. And I only had to drive 15 minutes to get a year's worth of chemo, radiation, test, visits, you name it. It was there within 1 year. And it was so nice to be close. And in that waiting room, when I would wait for my test or chemo, I talked to people that were from Duluth, I mean, really far rural areas, and their husbands in their overalls or whatever were dragging their wives in, and they were just the most inspirational people to travel that far before you had to go to Rochester. And so the local care is part of a treatment. The local medicine that we had is part of the treatment. Because remember, if we can stay local with everything, we'll keep those doctors here. We'll have some great treatment. And also patients like myself, I had my friends, I had my family, I had my community. That was part of my treatment because they would show up at my treatments when they knew I was going. If I went to Rochester, all due respect, that far away, great facility, but I would have been a very lonely person and my husband would have been ready to kill me because he was very substantial and very supportive to me during my whole year there. So I'm going to end it that way, why I am on this bill with my local representative as well. This will really work well, and we can work it out. I know we can, and the experts to all my sides, please take heed to what they said, and thank you for listening to me and my personal story. Please come and visit. The building's on in construction. It's really cool. And if you also would like to attend, I'm speaking on a turn here, Santos, but if you'd like to come to the first, they call it the White Coat, and Representative Lieberman, you might know what that is, but the White Coat ceremony is coming up soon, and I can't wait to go to it, but I've asked for a white coat. I wanted to wear one today. They turned me down. So I did the best I could. So thank you again, Chair, Co-Chair, and all the members of this committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Perryman. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2229 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Finance Omnibus Bill. The bill is laid over. All right, members, the final bill on our agenda for today is House File 982. Representative Clardy, if you would please make your way to the testifier table. And while Representative Clardy does that, I will move that House File 982 be laid over for consideration. Excuse me, we had a last-minute change in the plans here. I will move that House File 982 be re-referred to the Committee on Veterans and Military Affairs. That is my motion, and Representative Clardy, welcome to the Higher Education Committee. We're grateful for your time, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Committee. I'm really excited to be here. We get a lot of bills that we get to work on, but this one was brought to me by my constituent, and he was so passionate about it. It was something I had to do and that I really wanted to do. It does have bipartisan support, and basically we always talk about how we should, at state and national, how we should honor and give gratitude and opportunities for veterans. So that's what the purpose of this bill is. So the purpose of this bill is to establish an education benefit for dependents of our disabled vets that are 100% disabled, 100% permanently disabled from the work that they did to help protect us. So this I have a bunch of notes here. So basically, it's by them. I'm sorry, for their dependents that are 100 are based on them being 100% disabled. And what else did I want to say? That it basically ensures that no dependent of a disabled veteran is held back from pursuing their academic dreams due to financial hardship. And Chair, I do have a couple testifiers here.
Thank you, Representative Clardy. Before we proceed to the testifiers, I'd like to note for members that you have an author's amendment labeled A1. And at this time, I'll move that the author's amendment be put, I'll move that amendment so that we can get the bill in the form that the author wants. Representative Clardy, if you could please briefly explain the A1 amendment.
Absolutely. I actually spoke with one of your committee members here, and they kind of advised me that I should go to 100% because, again, not being a person that's in the military, I don't know what the classifications are, but they're like, I'm 70% disabled, and look at how I'm presenting. So we are looking at having someone that is 100% disabled versus the 70 that was in a print originally.
Member discussion to the A1 amendment. I recognize Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was looking at the A1 amendment, and I just wonder if there's a little bit of a drafting issue, because if you just do that amendment and change the number, you get with a disability rating of 100% or more. And I don't know if it's possible to
that
have
is
more
an
than
error.
100%.
I'm sorry, Chair. Chair Wilgamott.
Okay, Representative Liebling, thank you for bringing that to our attention. We will proceed by adopting the A1 amendment, and then after conferencing briefly with Co-Chair Rarick, we have agreed to waive our pre-filing rule and do an oral amendment. Okay, members, as we're trying to parse through the language of this bill, we are going to hear from Mr. Hopkins from House Research to provide clarification.
So, Mr. Chair and members, the bill is going to vets, which veterans, which has a might have a might be the best place to review this, but my understanding is that veterans can stack various kinds of disabilities, so it can be possible to be more than 100% disabled when you combine multiple kinds of disabilities.
Representative Clardy, how would you like us to proceed with the A1 amendment?
Yes, so move, as is, based on the explanation. So,
okay, members, we will adopt the A1 amendment, and then we are, again, my motion is to re-refer the bill to Veterans and Military Affairs. We will be sure to make note of that to those co-chairs and committee members, and they can pick up that question there. Okay, any further discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Clardy, I see that you have two testifiers here to provide testimony on this bill. Please present your, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, I'm, my name, pardon me for a minute. Chair, Madam Chair, thank you for this time. My name is Alan Gursky. I'm 100% disabled American veteran. That's because I was in the Navy for 20 years. Defending our country to its fullest. And I am married with 4 children. They will be of college age coming up here soon. And Sorry, I'm not very hip with talking with you.
You're doing wonderful. You're doing wonderful. Oh, please proceed.
And let me see. I'm on my notes here. This benefit would be for 100% disabled veterans. Would be a good investment for them people. Not just for me alone, but for all veterans that are 100%. As you know, this, because as a veteran at 100%, I'm at a fixed income. I don't know if people know that or not, but at 100%, you just get so much from the VA and so much from your retirement, and that's when that not cover the cost of this college for four children. So that's the reason why I come here asking to pass this bill. And and another thing, I've been doing a lot of legwork on my own, talking to several senators and House of Representatives on both sides of the aisle for the past month. And all the ones I have talked to, they were all for this bill. Matter of fact, I see one that I have talked to on this committee here.
Thank you.
And
go ahead, please continue.
And so I'm asking for your support for this bill. Thank you, and God bless.
Well, thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you so much for your testimony, and thank you so much for your service. Thank you. If you could please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Trent Dilks, Legislative Director for the Disabled American Veterans Department of Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this bill. Compliments to my fellow testifier. I have been working on and off on this for over a decade. That's how long I've been working for Minnesota's veterans. I had kind of given up on it, and then the phone started ringing and kept ringing and kept ringing. And it really helped remind me how important this benefit could be. When we look around, we see that this is something that other states have been able to prioritize. Just a fun fact for you, I'm not comparing states, but I kind of am. Alabama is number one in this. If you are 40% disabled veteran, it is 10 semesters free college education for your dependents. So anything we do here will be short of Alabama, but I'm hopeful we can do something. As I work with veterans and I work with the, you know, we get kind of lost in the numbers, 100% disabled, things like that. I will tell you, with over a decade of this work, what we're really talking about, especially with younger veterans, is some of the more severe disabilities from this generation of war. Traumatic brain injuries and post-traumatic stress disorder. As we look at the numbers and we talk about the percentages, we can often forget what those impacts mean on the dependents. If you're the dependent of a veteran who is suffering from a high level of disability from post-traumatic stress disorder, TBI, the two most common disabilities for the generation that would have kids that are coming of college age, you have paid your own dues. You have been a caretaker for your veteran. You have provided things for them. And the ability to provide this benefit is a small way of saying thank you to those dependents, I think would be a wonderful, wonderful gesture. The changes to the FAFSA mean that disability compensation will not be included after the 24-25 school year here. So I think as you look at a fiscal impact, you're probably looking at a much smaller number than previous years that looked at this, because disability compensation is a non-taxable. So as you look at those numbers, I understand the budget realities. I'm working on a lot of different issues for veterans, but this is a group who have paid their dues. Not just their veterans, but their dependents have paid their dues. So any opportunity to make this a reality in Minnesota would be greatly appreciated. It's been a priority of the Commander's Task Force for over a decade. Honestly, we gave up and dropped it off of our agenda for the first time in over a decade just this year.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on House File 982? Seeing none, we will now go to member discussion. I recognize Representative Duran.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to let everybody know that I am co-author on this bill here. I do support it. I think this is a great bill to actually give back to our community members that have served our country and fought for us. So I am also the one to ask for the amendment as well to it. I just felt like we were as a state financially, and who I know as local veterans who are disabled at 100%, I wanted to make sure that they got first dibs at this. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Further member discussion to House File 982. I recognize Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Clardy, for being here, and to your testifiers. I am inclined to support the bill. I think it's great. I just had one quick question. It says that it's they can enroll in schools operated by the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota, and I believe Minn State, although I'm not seeing it right now. I just wondered, why is it limited to that? The state grant is available to public schools, tribal schools, so I just wondered, would you consider making it available to whatever school they're interested in attending? Minnesota school, just to be clear, here in Minnesota.
Representative Clardy.
I would be open to the conversation. When this bill was being structured, I was trying to keep parallel to some existing funding that's going on in the state of Minnesota, because there's some, this is just how I'm thinking through, but there's some grant opportunities that are out there, but they are only going to public, so I was trying to be more parallel. I'm open to the discussion. I would have no problem with it, but I'm just wondering what the public would want.
Anything further, Representative Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Clardy. I appreciate that, because the state grant is open to everyone, and it's limited by the amount that students who attend the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, the highest level of public tuition. So it is even. It's not giving more dollars to kids who go to private schools. So I would encourage you to just consider that. But it's a great bill, and thank you. And thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Further member discussion to House File 982. I recognize Representative Co-Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I'm looking at this, we have another misalignment, and I'm looking at Mr. Hopkins. So since we changed it from 70% to 100% in line 1.14, it doesn't align anymore starting in line 1.18 when it says a few words in, the award is 50% of the actual items. So you have 100% for 100% disability, and it did say 50% covering tuition fees and books and so on for a 70% disability, but now that we've changed it to 100% or more, it doesn't really align. I'm wondering, so we have an issue with the language now that we did that amendment.
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Rarick, so the 50% at 1.18 is just referring to the amount of the award. Mm-hmm. And so the bill creates two different sort of classes of eligibility. So you can be eligible if you are the dependent of a child of a veteran with a total and permanent disability, and that entitles you to 100% of the actual tuition and fees. You can see that at 1.15. And then if you are eligible because you are the child of a veteran with not a permanent disability, but a disability rating of 100% or more, that entitles you to that 50% award at 1.18.
Representative Rarick.
I don't know if Mr. Hopkins had more.
Mr. Hopkins. There are two different kinds of eligibility under the bill, depending on the disability status of the veteran. And there are two different kinds of awards levels in the bill that correspond to those two kinds of eligibility.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just something to look at as you go to the Veterans Committee, the two authors of the bill, if you want to keep it at just 50%, since you change it from 70% disability to 100% disability or more, because I don't, just something to look at because you've changed that eligibility, and just something to think about. So otherwise, I don't have any issues with the bill, and I think we're sending it to veterans, so that sounds great. Thank you.
Mr. Dilks.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I just to touch base on that 100% thing, it gets very confusing. I hope that it'll be looked at to just put it at 100%. Those who are not permanent total are your veterans who are suffering from cancers that are likely to become, were the veterans likely to become deceased or likely to have a major surgery and portions of their body removed. I don't think those are the dependents that we would mean to leave out of something like this. Permanent and total gets thrown around a lot, but those subject to reevaluation are often those who are terminally ill or those who there's a possibility of a major and drastic intervention. So they check in on them every 2 to 3 years to see if they've died or if they've had the cancer removed. So I just hope we'll look at the 100% as the level for that and correct the language, because you're correct that it creates an inconsistency.
Thank you, Mr. Dilks. Further discussion on House File 982, I recognize Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, my first question just got answered by Mr. Hopkins. So the only other question I had is, what, if any, conversations have you had with MDVA about how this might interact with the State Soldiers Assistance Program? And the reason I ask is because I carried a bill on that last year when I was on the Veterans Committee, and it got a little bit hairy as we talked about making some changes there, and ended up that it may well have had a budget impact within higher education because of the impact to, in particular, Minn State schools. So just want to make sure you're kind of thinking about that and curious if you've had any conversations about what those interactions might look like.
Mr. Dilks.
Mr. Chair, I'm familiar with the various attempts to do this, and I believe that one was looking at either the State Soldier Assistance Program becoming a last dollar in or essentially a rounding down of the tuition, where this one is looking to create a scholarship fund to put those rates in. So whether the State Soldiers Assistance Program, I would envision, because they always have rollover money anyway, would be one of those funds that could be pitched in before you would look at the amount out of the scholarship, again, reducing the overall commitment of funds. So I think they work together very well in this way. In that way, everybody argues about who's the last dollar in, and everybody puts last dollar in, and nobody gets to be last. So that's where the confusion was on that one.
Is there any further member discussion to House File 982? Seeing none, Representative Clardy, closing remarks.
Thank you, committee, again. I'm glad I brought two lifelines. I couldn't have done it on my own. This shows your unwavering dedication to those that have served us and commitment. So I look forward to taking this to Veterans Committee, and I really thank you for your comments and your reflection on the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Clardy. Members, I will renew my motion that House File 982, as amended, be re-referred to the House Committee on Veterans and Military Affairs. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. There being no further business before the committee, the House Higher Education, Finance, and Policy Committee is now adjourned.